This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
We look forward to listening to the next talk on complication of portal hypertension management dilemma. It's given by Bilal Hamid, and Dr. Hamid was trained at University of Minnesota by Jack Lake. I think most of you know who Jack is. And so he came here for the hepatology fellowship and then joined the faculty here 2 years ago. So I typically would see Jack about 2-3 times a year, and every single time he would really remind me that he did me a big favor by letting Bilal come here. Up to this point, I can't figure out what I can do to pay him back. So I'm not sending anybody over. So Dr. Mee is a truly superb clinician, and he would challenge us to make some good clinical decisions in various difficult clinical scenarios that are related to portal hypertension. Bilal?
Thank you, Francis. Thanks, everyone, for coming here. When I started preparing for this talk, I first thought, I don't know what I did, but Francis gave me this topic because I was not in that meeting. So, just joking. Anyway, when I was coming to Napa, I was telling my wife that this is the fourth year I'm here. The first time we were here, and I was coming alone on my two-door sports car, and then every year it's like one, so now we have four people in our car. So I hope that it just stops here. So the complications of portal hypertension is such a big topic, and it was very difficult to figure it out at this level that, you know, most of us knows about the basics. So my thinking was to talk about some more clinical questions which we see every day and which are more controversial and may actually get your expertise also, that what are all of you are doing in those clinical scenarios, and also learn from all of you to see whether we can improve ourselves. So I have no financial disclosure. So the outline of my talk, I wanted to focus on three basic things which I feel that we ask a lot of questions about it, and we don't know, not too much data, and we see it differently for every patient. So first is, how do we manage portal vein thrombosis in patients who have cirrhosis? Not malignant or ACC, just a patient with non-ACC portal vein thrombosis. Second is, what about sepsis and bacterial infection and cirrhosis, which we actually see all of us every day in our ICU? And it's a big controversy about which antibiotics to use. And the third, which is actually a little bit old data, but actually is still reasonable in some clinical scenario, that whether there are some patients that we can actually use a TIPS procedure for early variceal bleed. So I start with a clinical scenario. We have a 59-year-old male with hepatitis C who is a nurse, had small varices and a MELD score of 12. He had an ultrasound for just ACC surveillance, and ultrasound showed that he had a new portal vein thrombosis. So he has all these questions for you. And the first question he asked is, how common is portal vein thrombosis and cirrhosis? I am the rare person that has received, had got it. And does it impact my liver transplantation? It can a pre-transplant or post-transplant? And the bigger question that all of we face it occasionally, that patient asks us, does I need anticoagulation? So what is the prevalence of portal vein thrombosis? So different studies have shown different, but if you have a compensated cirrhosis, the studies on autopsy series shows it can be 1%. However, the rising incidence, if you are more decompensated because it's been patients who are listed for liver transplantation, it can be up to 8 to 25%. One study actually shows that the risk of developing portal vein thrombosis is 3 to 10%, but none of the other studies have actually changed that, you know, whether it has been true, but the 3 to 10% have been used in this study. The important concept which we are using is the decreased velocity of portal vein flow seems to be the most important local factor for thrombosis. And this is a study done by Zocco which actually shows that if you have a decreased portal vein flow of less than 15, those are the patients who actually have an increased risk of developing portal vein thrombosis in the future. When we talk about the management and prophylaxis, there is some data. So we need to figure out whether there is a group of patients we can consider that, you know, we have to either follow them more closely or consider them, whether these are the patients we can consider thinking about using some treatment for the future. There is some new data coming out that these patients have increased factor 8 levels. So does portal vein thrombosis, having a portal vein thrombosis pre-liver transplant, increase your post-transplant mortality? There are multiple studies, small studies have different results. I tried to put three smaller studies, and I'm going to show a bigger SRTR database on the next slide. So there's a study by Ravioli who had 91 patients, and they divided in partial portal vein thrombosis and complete portal vein thrombosis. The one thing is, when you look at the literature, is about how all these studies, how they define portal vein thrombosis, what are their definition of complete or partial thrombosis, and what is the timing and what is the definition of chronic. Most of the studies use that if you have a portal vein thrombosis less than 6 months, it's more considered acute. Greater than 6 months, it's more chronic portal vein thrombosis. So anyway, if you have partial or complete portal vein thrombosis, you have increased 30-day post-transplant mortality. The latest study from Ravioli that shows that, you know, you have 12% portal vein thrombosis, 12% risk of mortality 30 days. So I don't know why the slide didn't show it up that well, but anyway, portal vein thrombosis and liver transplant. So the University of Michigan group, they look at the SRTR database, and they had found that from 2001 to December of 2007, they took 22,000 patients who had a liver transplant. And they found that 4% at the time of transplant had portal vein thrombosis, with the number is about 897. And the predictor of post-transplant mortality was portal vein thrombosis, and the hazard ratio of 1.32. There's a lot of controversy about it. If you look at the editorial, some people say that there are a lot of patients with portal vein thrombosis. We don't see that. But this is actually just think about that there is increased risk, possible increased risk in these patients. There are data that actually suggest that if you have portal vein thrombosis, the surgery is longer, you require more blood transfusion, and increased risk of infection also post-transplantation. So that is a real deal that we see. So what about the treatment? Is there our clinical trial? There are about actually four clinical trials retrospectively which has been looked at the coagulation, anticoagulation in patients with chronic portal vein thrombosis just in cirrhosis. So this is a study which was published this year, and they divided into two groups. One was patient who was on Coumadin, and 26 patients was treated with low molecular weight heparin for about 6 months. The complete recanalization, which is like complete resolution of the clot, was seen in about 45% of the patient. If you combine whether there's a partial or complete, it can be seen in about 65% patient. Their finding was that if you start the anticoagulation within 6 months of finding it, these patients have the best chance of having recanalization. However, after 6 months, once they stopped the treatment, 39% did develop rethrombosis. So we don't know how long to use this anticoagulation and what to do after, and there is a time frame, or we just keep doing it. 9% of the patient did develop bleeding, and the biggest risk factor for bleeding is platelet count of less than 50. And most of our patients' platelet count to start with is about 60, 70, 50, and the low molecular weight heparin does increase the risk of HIT and also further decrease the platelet count. So the other three studies, which I tried to put it and tried to make sense of, is the first study was Franco's, who had 29 patients, just patients on the first, who were listed for liver transplantation. So they used combination of low molecular weight heparin and Coumadin, and 10 patients were untreated. So the percent of patients who had complete recanalization was 42% versus zero who was untreated. And they only had one variceal bleed in this group. The second study was Emitrano, who has about 28 patients. This was actually a prospective single arm, and they used anticoagulation, which is enoxaparin in this case, was more than 6 months. And in this study, the percent of complete recanalization was 33, and 50% had partial recanalization. They didn't mention, they didn't have any bleeding in this study. However, the latest study which came out was from Sansolo, who had 54 patients. It was a prospective case-controlled study, and they actually used nitroprusside and on 33 patients, and 21 patients were untreated. Again, the complete recanalization was seen in 36 patients. 27% has partial recanalization. However, the interesting finding on this study that patients who were untreated, 71% had progression of thrombosis, meaning that it was either extending to the SMV during the study period. But one of the patients in the study had cerebral bleed, one had variceal bleed, and one patient, the medication was stopped because of heparin-induced thrombocytopenia similar. So there is a risk and the cause, and we have to find the risk and benefit. So the interesting study that came out, which was actually was in ASLD session last year, and then this was just published recently, was about the prophylaxis. So what happened if you wanted to prophylax based on the data that these patients can have worsened outcome after liver transplantation, they can have worsened bleeding, they can have worsening ascites. So what they did, they randomized, which was unblinded, 70 patients, mostly with Charles P and C. And their arm was that they did 12 months of treatment and then followed for 12 months. One patient was withdrawn because of hepatic, heparin-induced thrombocytopenia. But greater than 50% of these patients had decrease in the platelet count. Their exclusion criteria was if you have platelet count of less than 100. So majority of these patients had platelet count of greater than 100. May not be applicable in most of our patients. They had three episodes of esophageal variceal bleed, and two in the treatment group and one in the placebo group. So this was their results. So on the enoxaparin, which was 4,000 units per day, and the people can argue, how can you come up with this dose, because it's weight-based and every patient in cirrhosis is different and what weight dose medication to use. Anyway, if you have acute portal vein thrombosis while waiting, while on treatment, none of the patient in enoxaparin developed portal vein thrombosis, and 16% patient on placebo arm did develop it. At the end of follow-up, 8% in enoxaparin group did develop portal vein thrombosis, however 27% in placebo group. The survival was better, but the numbers are not that big to make any conclusion out of it. However, when you had the patients who did develop portal vein thrombosis, only 4% enoxaparin had hepatic decompensation, and 18 patients, which is about 60%, had hepatic decompensation in the placebo group. So this was actually got a lot of press last year, and it's one of the study. The other part of the study was, which I found very interesting, they actually look at the stool bacterial DNA, and they actually have a theory that these patients where enoxaparin somehow has improvement in the intestinal circulation, and that may be one of the reasons that, you know, these patients do better. It's a very unique idea, but, you know, we definitely need more studies and more, but it's a pretty unique thing that they did during the study. So this is, again, is the graph. Again, if you look at the solid line on the first, on your right side, is the probability of developing portal vein thrombosis. So none of the patient did develop with the solid, and only after they stopped the treatment after 96 weeks that there is a first patient who developed portal vein thrombosis. They have a better, less chance of having decompensation and also better survival. So what about the tips? There are actually some studies which actually been used or done in patients with portal vein thrombosis tips. And mainly the tips was done because they had worsening hepatic decompensation and most of them had variceal bleed or had worsening ascites. So if you look at the different studies, the big one was from 2010, which has 128 patients. And the success, because the one question is whether your radiologist can do a TIPS procedure. And again, it depending on whether you have partial occlusion or complete occlusion, it all depends on that. But it's successful in most of the cases, like two-thirds of the cases, it can be successful. So the only two studies that have actually shown that you can have a complete recanalization of portal vein after putting a TIPS. So the latest study from Luca from 2011 last year was 70 patients, and they have about 100% technical success, and about 60% of those patients had complete recanalization. So this was actually L-Trombach study, which is like, you know, the I just wanted to put it because with the Hep C treatment, there's a lot of debate now. All of you may be using L-Trombach, and I just wanted to put it as in that the study was done and recently published in New England Medical Journal. There are 292 patients, and most of these patients had platelet count of less than 50. So the finding of the study that, you know, six patients in the portal in the L-Trombach arm did develop portal vein thrombosis versus one in the placebo. And this is actually the reason that the study was terminated. So just a caution that if you are using it, just be a close watch on L-Trombach for development of, or just look out for portal vein thrombosis and at least do an ultrasound before starting that. So what about the risk of bleeding? That's a big question that everyone asks. You're starting anticoagulation, and most of our patients have varices. And so this was actually a study which is a retrospective study, but patients who are non-cirrhotic portal vein thrombosis. They were not cirrhotic. They were about 136 patients. And their median follow-up was about 46 months. They had about 84 bleeding episodes, but on 42 patients. And their incidence of first bleeding was 35%, and the recurrent bleed was 58%. It's pretty high. If you look at the hazard ratio or risk ratio of how, what are the biggest risk, and as expected, these patients with moderate to large varices. One thing I did not mention that all these other studies which has in the treatment group, they did, their protocol was to do EGDs and actually obliterate the varices before starting the anticoagulation, which makes sense, but there are reports of post-pending ulcers, and when do you restart, when do you start anticoagulation. Most of the studies use 2 weeks time after they obliterate the varices before starting anticoagulation. So the questions. So the question is, does portal vein thrombosis alter the natural history of cirrhosis? There are data that suggest that this patient may have worsening decompensation, or the question is that you have worsening decompensation and that's the cause of portal vein thrombosis. When and what to start, whether you start Coumadin or you start low molecular weight heparin. And if you start it, is there any duration? How long to keep using the medication, which we don't have any answer. And the other bigger question is that if you start Coumadin, can we follow the INR, which we know that it's only being used in patients who are not cirrhotic. And also, if you have low molecular weight heparin, can you follow anti-10A level, which most of the study shows that you cannot use it because of all the changes that happen with the procoagulin and the anticoagulin and happen with cirrhosis. And what are the time that you consider TIPS? The question also comes in is there are selected group of patients, there are very selected few that you can actually consider or think about using anticoagulation. So, you know, whether there are patients who are listed for transplantation or especially retransplantation, now we are seeing a lot of patients who are considered candidate for retransplantation and they have portal vein thrombosis, and we know that if there are progression, we need to be very active with this because they won't be transplant candidate. Whether in any patient we have seen that there is a progression and you wanted to prevent the progression of SMV, and the patient who have prothrombotic. So there are, the data is not great about how many patients with cirrhosis, if they have thrombosis, what is the prothrombotic incidence. Some of the study shows 30% of it, but again, as you all know, that most of these studies are very difficult to interpret when you have cirrhosis. The other thing is whether there is any role for prophylaxis. So we don't have any great data besides the one I presented, but this is the emerging field, and more of our patients, more and more patients we see, and this is the condition we will be seeing. So either we need to work on either having a local protocol, or it have to be very case by case, and this is, we have to work together to find it. But there are no clear answers right now. Everyone does it differently. I have a couple of patients which I have been on anticoagulation with very specific scenarios. I tried to find it. ASLD EASL doesn't have any guideline. This was, I don't know whether you can see it from distance, but anyway, this was from Karsia Bakan, who actually, come up with this idea and such a complicated topic, and that's why this table is so complicated, and tried to figure out what they mean. But it actually means that you consider anticoagulation, and that's what their recommendation most of the time. But the interesting thing, which I tried to highlight it at the bottom, is that their consideration that you start anticoagulation, and if you don't see any recanalization improvement at 2 or 3 months mark, you should consider a TIPS procedure. So it's a very controversial idea, but there's a lot of people who actually promote this, think about that, actually using TIPS in early on. So again, this is what the data and have it, and it's just some guideline that if you wanted to follow, that you follow, at least look at it. So the same patient, now switching to the infection and sepsis, the same patient we have with portal vein thrombosis came to the hospital now. We didn't start anticoagulation for sure in this patient. So now came in with hypothermia, hypotension, and tachycardia. So he was admitted to the ICU with sepsis. So his family's asking, so what is the chance of him dying during this hospitalization? What is the likely source of infection in this patient? What antibiotic you wanted to start in this patient who is in the ICU? Whether you just start with third-generation cephalosporin, or you can wanted to consider vancomycin or gram-negative baseline coverage. Or like me, when I see this patient, I can scream and see what I should do, and it's always scary when this patient comes to our hospital. So what are the infections? So bacterial infection is the leading cause of mortality in patients with cirrhosis. There is data that 1/3 of the patients who were admitted to the hospital with cirrhosis at least have one infection. These causes prolonged admission, acute kidney injury, death, and delisting from transplantation. And our hospital, that's one of the main reasons they get septic, and we delist from liver transplantation because they're too sick for transplant. So ICU mortality with cirrhosis has remained unchanged over the past 50 years. And unfortunately, there is no randomized controlled trial in patients with sepsis and cirrhosis. We are now seeing increased multi-drug-resistant organism, and some latest studies shows that up to 40% of these patients have multi-drug resistance organism. So what about the hospitalized infection, hospitalized cirrhosis patient infection? So this is actually 8 centers from the U.S. which actually form a consortium and to actually look at the patients who are admitted with cirrhosis in the hospital. And this study was published by Dr. Bajaj recently in Hepatology, and their goal was to look at it, what are the infections they're seeing in patients who are admitted to their hospital. So they have about 207 patients, and the most first infection were hospital-acquired infection, and the nosocomial infection 15%. The second infection was seen in 50 patients, which is 24%. So when there are different theories in ID literature, what you define what infection. So the community-acquired infection is that the patient has never been admitted to the hospital in the last 6 months or did not require any antibiotic. And once they get admitted to the hospital, it's called community-acquired. Hospital-acquired infections are that they have been admitted to the hospital in the last 6 months and required antibiotic. If they come to the hospital, you find an infection within 48 hours, it's considered hospital-acquired infection. And the nosocomial infection is that if you didn't have any cultures or any culture or any other evidence of sepsis within the 48 hours and the infection develop after 48 hours, it's considered nosocomial. The first infection is that you find the infection on when they get admitted. The second infection is that they didn't have any infection the first 5 days of admission, and then you find an infection, it's considered second infection. So in this study, 24% of the patient had a second infection when they were admitted to the hospital. And their mortality, 30-day mortality, was 23%. This is not sepsis. It's just every cirrhotic patient coming to their hospital. The case fatality was higher for C. diff, which was up to 40%. Their calculation that beside the MELD score, which is expected as an increased cause of mortality, the second infection was the highest reason that people were dying. So this was actually the distribution of first infection. And if you look at the blue is the community acquired, the red is the hospital acquired, and the green is nosocomial. So if you can look at it, that on the urine tract infection and the C. diff was mostly nosocomial infection. And as expected, SBP is the most common infection in patient admitted to the hospital. The respiratory infection, and this is like when they call 13%, is mostly aspiration that patient get pretty encephalopathic and we don't work on it quickly and patient aspirate, and that is also a big nosocomial cause of infection. So if you look at what is the difference between the first infection, again, which was have it in the first 5 days when the patient admitted, or the second infection, which was when they were in the hospital for 5 days. So clearly, respiratory infection, again, was the biggest second infection. The UTI also slightly, and then the C. diff. So the fungal infection was up to 14%, which is, and most of these, the risk factor for fungal infection were patient in the ICU, on dialysis, and on prolonged antibiotics. There is an emerging literature coming out that enterococcus has been an increased cause of SPP. This is a study which, again, recently published about 170 episodes of positive ascites culture from 2000 and 2011. They actually divided the study into different time frame to make sure that there is no significant change. So gram-positive infection, although we all think the gram-negative is the most, but this study shows that gram-positive is up to 50%. And enterococcus was seen up to 28% cases. And nosocomial infection and the recent antibiotic was, again, the biggest risk factor. And poor survival in enterococcus group. So what about the cirrhosis and the ICU admission with sepsis? So the estimated number of ICU admission related to the United States is up to 26,000 per year, and they're about estimated cost of $3 billion. The mortality in patients with cirrhosis, when they admitted with sepsis to the ICU, 30-day mortality, 60 to 80%. And it's amazing that all the other chronic conditions is up only 50%. And all the other chronic conditions, including renal failure, heart failure, they actually, the survival of sepsis is getting better except for cirrhosis. So what about the septic shock and cirrhotic patients? So this is a big consortium of about 28 hospitals in Canada, US, and Saudi Arabia. And they actually had the septic network, which they follow all the septic patients. They have about 6,000 patients in their database. So retrospectively, look at patients with cirrhosis, and they have about 635 patients. Again, 28 medical center. I don't know why they named CATS. The mortality is 75%. So this was actually much higher than what we expected. Fungal infection was seen in 10% of these patients. 25% of these patients met the criteria of septic shock but was culture negative. So their theory was that whether there is a delay in starting antibiotic and that's the cause of these people dying. So what they found out that inappropriate initial empiric antimicrobial coverage, which is when you have sepsis, there is a bundle protocol in most of the hospital but does not apply to cirrhosis for some reason. And so 24% patient did not got the appropriate initial antimicrobial coverage. And the median time to start the right antibiotic was about 7.3 hours. And most of the patients with sepsis need to start the antibiotic within the first 6 hours, clearly shown to improve survival. Patient with septic shock was on single antibiotic rather than two or more antibiotic in 72% of these cases. It was right across all the hospitals, doesn't matter which region is it. So this was a very eye-opener that, you know, these patients who need a lot of antibiotic early on did not get the right antibiotic. Again, this is the graph. It shows that the hours, that how long it took for to start the antibiotic, and about 7.3 hours in most, and that clearly associated with mortality. Again, it's not showing, but just the graph was supposed to show that, you know, it's just inappropriate antibiotic and increases the odds ratio. So when we look at our data, that, you know, we were trying to find out that most of our patients was on these antibiotics for a long period of time, and can we do better, and what antibiotic protocol that we can use it, because when these patients coming to UCSF from other hospitals who were septic or in the ICU, you know, these patients were on different antibiotic and what to use. So one of our pharmacist team and with infectious disease, and Orin was also part of this study, look at their our experience, what we were seeing at UCSF. So it was a retrospective study. They had 108 patients between 2009, January to October of 2010. The inclusion criteria was that you need to be in the ICU for more than 3 days. As region 5, our average MELD score in our ICU patients was 32. We have 48% patients who had met the criteria of sepsis, and mortality was seen in 41%. Although we can see that we have a much better care, that we were better mortality, but we did have some acute liver failure patient, and that's one of the reasons. So average duration of antibiotic and was 19 days. So we were using a lot of antibiotic for a long period of time. But what surprised all of us was that we did have a lot of Candida species and VRE, and we did not have a single MRSA in the whole group, because our protocol was to use vancomycin, and only when patient was crashing and we were calling the family about the comfort care and added linezolid and caspofungin as the last minute. So we thought that, you know, maybe we can do better, and there are a group of patients that need more aggressive antibiotic for the first on. So we have this protocol now in force for the past 8 or 9 months, and we will going to look up whether we made any changes. So this is the two division we made. One is, what is the empiric antibiotic we use in ICU who did not had any significant prior antibiotic? So the goal is to start through the culture before starting the antibiotic, and we normally use Zosyn, Vanco, and Fluconazole right off the bat. If the cultures are negative, then we basically stop the antibiotic and just continue Zosyn for 7 days. At the same time, if there's any worse thing, decompensation of the patient, we go to change the antibiotic, and we change the Zosyn to meropenem, Vanco to linezolid, and Fluke to caspofungin, again for 48 hours to see if any cultures come back positive and have the ID consult. What about the patient, which are majority of the patients of us who comes to the other hospital who are already on antibiotic or in sepsis? So our protocol now is that we, after getting the blood culture, we right off the bat, we start meropenem, linezolid, and caspofungin. Again, this is just based on what our data, which the slide didn't show it up, because again, we had about 54% patient with candida in the urine, and about 12% in fungal infection in the blood, and our VRE was about 12 to 15%. So that's why we using this protocol of mero, linezolid, and caspo. Again, we only, the goal is to have an upfront antibiotic and see what the patient does in the 48 hours. If the patient did not have VRE or MRSA, ESBL, or yeast, we actually stop all these antibiotics and change the mero to Zosyn for 7 days and then reassess. Again, we were going to see if that whether we made any changes in our next year, and so we'll see whether there's an improvement in the mortality or change in the culture that we have. We have to be very cautious. We do use, all of us use a lot of antibiotic, and that's changing, and that developing a lot of multi-drug resistant organisms. So it's very tough situation, and so that is, it's not perfect, but that's what at least we are doing at UCSF right now. So switching to varices. So same patient now, he's a year later, 6 year old now, hep C, admitted with GI bleed now. He was started on octreotide and antibiotic. We did an EGD and showed large, very acute variceal bleed, and it was his first variceal bleed, and we put 5 bands onto it. So the question is whether you just continue octreotide and antibiotic for 5 days, you repeat the EGD 2 to 3 weeks later. If we re-bleed, we consider TIPS, or we can consider TIPS on him right now. So this is the slide with Dr. Liberg gave it to me. So how many patients are getting TIPS at UCSF? So 25% of at UCSF is getting a TIPS for bleeding, and 71% is getting it for ascites, and 4% sometimes we're doing a surgery and they need a preoperative decompression. That's the other indication we have used it. So most of the guidelines say that we use the TIPS as a rescue therapy for recurrent variceal hemorrhage, which is if you have a second re-bleed from esophageal varices or the first re-bleed of gastric varices. And, you know, DIPSS is indicated if you have re-bleed on combination therapy. There is data that if you have jowl ANP cirrhosis, the splenorenal shunt is as effective at DIPSS. So there, in the past, we had pyramidal tips, and now we have covered stent tips. We did have improved patency of the tips. Now, 1 year, we have up from 50% now up to 80%. However, this recent study shows that there is no difference in hepatic encephalopathy whether you use pyramidal or covered stents, and the average is about 30 to 50%, a little bit higher than what we normally see. So the hepatic venous pressure gradient is the most important thing that predict your bleeding and what are the patients who have a chance of re-bleeding. This is an old study which actually shows that most of these patients who have acute variceal bleed, they have a gradient is about 20, but it varies anywhere between 12 to 35. If you use the tip for acute variceal bleed, which is, you know, again, when you have a second bleed, so this is the combination of all the data that is out there for a second episode of bleed, and there are 306 patients. If you can see that very effective in controlling the bleeding, almost up to 90 to 100%, you can control the bleeding, but there is a high mortality in someone who have an acute variceal bleed. So again, very good in controlling, but high mortality. So this is a slide showing that what are the risks of re-bleeding in patients you see every day with variceal. So if you does not treat them, you have about 60 to 70% chance that they will re-bleed. If you just use beta blocker, it's about 50%. If you use PAM ligation, it's still not perfect. It's about close to 40%. However, if you put the tips in, the chance of it is 15%. But this is a new concept that is actually developing, especially in Europe, and we're not that in tune right now. The important thing is when you put a tips in, what is your pressure gradient? And whether you dictate what the pressure gradient is, and that's are the patients who have very high risk of bleeding. And this concept has been used, and there are two studies. The first one was actually published in 2004, which used early tips for patient with pressure gradient of greater than 20. They have 116 cirrhotics and they divided into two groups. Basically, one group of patients who have less than 20 and they did routine therapy with band ligation, octreotide, and 52 patients who have a high gradient, they randomized to TIPS versus the routine therapy. So the study shows that if patients who have an early TIPS who has a high pressure gradient have a reduced transfusion rate, reduced rate of re-bleeding, and also decrease in hospital and one-year mortality. And this graph shows that if you have like gradient of less than 20, you actually do really well. However, if your gradient is greater than 20 and you put a TIPS in, this is the patient you actually have a much chance as compared to patient you did not put a TIPS in. So there may be a group of patients you have to be maybe aggressive early on. So same concept, and but a little bit different, that New England Medical Journal article from Dr. From Spain in 2010. So they actually divided on Charles PNC cirrhosis based on which are the group of patients who have a high risk. So they have 63 patients who have Charles C and or B with persistent bleeding. So they divided into two groups, 31 who underwent PAM ligation, 32 with early TIPS. And patients who have early TIPS have only one patient, the early TIPS group, has re-bleeding or failure to control bleeding as compared to 14 patients who did not have a TIPS procedure. Same with survival. So the 1 year survival was 61% in the treatment group, which is PAM ligation and medication, versus 86% early TIPS. So what about the TIPS survival? A lot of patients ask, like, what are the chance? Which are the patients? So this is actually a different meta-analysis, and this is basically a meta-analysis of patients who compared with the TIPS versus large volume paracentesis. But I find this slide very interesting, especially we were talking about the melsodium, but it actually shows that patients who are more than age 60, who have elevated bilirubin and low sodium, are the patients who does not do that well with the TIPS procedure. And we have seen in elderly, when we try to put a TIPS in, they don't have that much a better outcome than young. However, if you are age 50, you have a bilirubin of 1 and sodium of 140, these are the patients who did great from the survival point of view. So just so that in the back of mind, when you talk to the patient, especially for ascites, these are the parameter you use, and you know that we all know that the MEL score actually been used. You started using for TIPS procedure, and our UCSF, we use a MEL of 18, less than 18. Feel comfortable, again, we'll have to look at the bilirubin, and sometimes we're aggressive and we use 20, but I think it changes every time we talk to the IR. So again, the TIFS outcome, whether we just use the status quo or there's a new paradigm that we can use. Again, as all these patients, every patient is different, and we have to use and the guidelines which can help us, but every patient we have to look at differently. And again, with the TIFS, whether the pressure gradient and there are MELD score, JAL score, sodium, age, we have to take into account. And there are a group of patients that we can consider early TIFS, not only in bleeding, but also in ascites. There is actually a clinical trial that's going on for doing a TIFS early on in the ascites group also. So, the last thing, you didn't show it up, but I think most of you have the subscription of Archive of Internal Medicine, and you all read it. But there was an article just came out last month about the burnout of physicians. So I wanted to end my talk, and I wanted to ask you, so what your group idea, how many physicians have at least one symptom of burnout?
Zero.
So it's 46%. That this is actually, they had a database and they asked question to about 5,000 physicians and 7,000 non-physicians. And they compared the physician versus the non-physician. And what's your guess, which specialty has the most burnout? So family medicine, internal medicine, and ER. And how many physicians are dissatisfied with work-life balance? So, all of you are here, and I think my point is that enjoy this and have a good balance in NAPA rather than just focusing on your patient, and that's what we try to do at UCSF. Thank you. Any questions? So the question is, if you have an elevated INR, is there a cutoff that you consider anticoagulation, and why do they clot? So there's actually a lot of studies that actually done that, there is a whole balance of procoagulant and anticoagulant. INR does not actually predict that you can, because that's a INR actually just form in patient just to detect on patient with Coumadin INR, and this does not reflect that whether you can have an increased risk, because there are a lot of changes that happen when you actually decompensate, because when our INR started going up, it's just a major that your liver is decompensated. There are a lot of factor 8 levels and thrombomodulin that start going up and these factors. So we cannot use that parameters. But again, those are the big concern that we know that this INR, we worry that it's likely a major of bleeding, and those are the patients. And again, that's the whole controversy. There are most of the studies they did it, they are actually have a MELD score of 12 or 13, so their INR was about 1.7, and those are the patients those we have to consider very high risk for bleeding. And and there is no right answer for that. Please.
So most of the data you shared was portal hypertension in cirrhotic patients. Can you apply some of this to the non-cirrhotic portal hypertension?
So the question is,
only one slide.
Right, yeah. So the question is whether the portal vein thrombosis is non-cirrhotic. So those patients, so the estimate, so what we think about 40 to 50% of patients with portal vein thrombosis are seen in cirrhosis, but there are a lot of group of patients who develop portal vein thrombosis, and that's likely the cause of their portal hypertension. So those patients, there is an ASLD guideline. Those guidelines are very well established that these patients need anticoagulation for 3 to 6 months if they don't have any thrombotic condition. So those are, and they, the data shows that you can have a recanalization, complete recanalization up to 50 to 70% of the patient with anticoagulation.
I have one. Oh, yes.
Please. What is the outcome or predicted outcome for the variability of bleeding from people pre-sinusoidal bleeding, liver function is normal?
So the question is, what is the prognosis of pre-sinusoidal hypertension. As far as, you know, to be honest, I don't have a clear answer for that because, I didn't look at the data that what is the prognosis of it. But most of these patients, again, who did not have the decompensation, one of the major problem, and, you know, you can actually help them with just banding, and they do actually really well. But I don't know the... You know, so the question is whether you, which condition you use it. There are a lot of, like, patients with nodular regenerative hypoplasia, VTC, very commonly and in our practice. And the, again, it's a, you're doing the test for just the variceal bleed or just prevention of the bleeding, but we are very aggressive in tips on those patients.
I just want to ask our surgeons, we pretty routinely perform liver transplant for even patient with portal vein thrombosis and cavernous transformation. But what percentage of time you need to use a drum graft? Like a John or Rio?
Probably less than half.
What percentage of time? I'm sorry?
Less than half.
Less than half of the time you need a drum graft, okay. All right. Okay. Yes, Henry.
With recent publication about use of PPI in patients with cirrhosis,
you know, everyone is on PPI, that's for sure. Whether it shows the increased risk of infection, you know, there's data of PPI about everything, especially the CDF data is very prominent. Interestingly, some of these studies, if you look at it, that some patients, some studies have shown a very high risk, but the only one study which I presented has shows the PPI may be increased risk. The other question is whether having on prophylaxis, SPP prophylaxis, increases the risk of all these other infection. And the data is not clear on, especially norfloxacin, that it does not show on the study that increases the risk of having more infection or sepsis.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.